All right, everybody. Let me introduce myself. My name is Andres Velasco. I'm the Dean of the School of Public Policy. So I've met some of you, but I haven't met all of you. I'm very proud. I now know there's an old academic building and a new academic building. I'm making great good progress. And I want to thank the co-sponsors and co-organizing of this event. There's Gareth back there, the Latin American crowd at LSE, very active organizing this. And of course, we are very, very honored and very happy to have a great guest and a great friend. You know, there are people that you, or at least one might introduce sort of lackadaisically, reluctantly, and there are people that you're really excited to introduce. Well, Ricardo is one of them. As you all know, Ricardo is the guy who runs the Center for International Development at a small institution in Boston called Harvard University. We were colleagues there for 7 years. Actually, we went to Harvard together, and then I left. So, you know, he claims that I owe him one, which may or may not be true. He is, he's a remarkable person because it's easy to find a really good technical economist. It's really easy to find a fairly competent policymaker. It's easy to find somebody who writes good pieces and editorials. It's easy to find somebody who does one thing. Ricardo does them all. I never cease to be impressed at the range of his talents. You know, he was planning minister in Venezuela. He was chief economist at the IGB, and as a result, you know, he's been there and knows how the world really works. He's a very accomplished economist with lots of interesting and creative papers to his name. He's also a political leader and somebody who never stops thinking about his beloved Venezuela. And of course, that is the subject of the talk tonight. I suspect I don't really have to persuade anybody in this room that what is going on in Venezuela is truly atrocious. We've moved, I think, from what used to be a political crisis to what used to be an economic crisis to what is today a humanitarian crisis, among other things. And I'm sure Ricardo will talk about this. And I am among those who think that the world owes Venezuela some help. You know, I'm a Chilean by birth, and I'm of an age such that my parents' generation were exiled from Chile by the dictatorship, and a lot of them found a hope, found a home, found a job in Venezuela. So, you know, I think many Democrats around Latin America are grateful to this day to what used to be the Venezuelan democracy, and I think we Democrats around Latin America have a task ahead of us, which is to help Venezuelans recover democracy. Needless to say, whatever I say, Ricardo will say much better and much more eloquently, so I'm just going to hand it over to him. He's going to give a presentation, which he says will be half an hour, but of course it will be 45 minutes, and then we will open it up for debate. Questions can be in English, in Spanish, or in any other language, because he speaks a bunch of them. Thank you very much.
Convenient for me to speak. I guess it's okay if I speak here, right?
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Andres, for that kind introduction. As the joke goes, my father would have appreciated it, and my mother would have believed it. So, it's really a pleasure and an honor to be back here at LSE, and this time I'm going to share some ideas on how to explain the Venezuelan catastrophe, because it's really, really a very unique event. It's not something that has occurred many times in human history, and so it should puzzle us as you know, what's behind this very, very odd phenomenon, and it should help us try to think of how to get out of it. So I'm going to share some ideas on it. At Harvard, I always had a group of Venezuelan students that would meet. We would meet Mondays at 6 p.m. after work and so on to discuss things Venezuela. But after the when it was clear that Venezuela was going, the Venezuelan opposition was going to win the legislative elections of December 2015, I decided that instead of just having sort of like a hobby, Venezuela being sort of like an after-work hobby for me, that maybe I should make it part of my day job. So we created a formal project on Venezuela. So I thought, you know, if I'm working on Sri Lanka, or if I'm working on Jordan, or if I'm working on Albania or Mexico or Argentina or wherever, why can't I work on Venezuela as my day job? Why does it have to be after hours? So I actually, you know, created a project on Venezuela, and we called it the Morning After Plan. So the question was, what would you do the morning after? And I, interestingly enough, I created an international advisory group for the Morning After Plan, and I included 6 people in the group, of which 2 are Andres Velasco and Eric Berger. So you see that it's a petit comité. So let me tell you a little bit what's been happening in Venezuela. You know that in Venezuela there are massive shortages. People line up for many things. They line up to buy food. They line up to get cash. They line up for to get the documents. They line up, and since, you know, at the end of the line there's nothing, they sort of like sometimes barge in. And after they barge in, they find out that there's nothing there, right? And because there's nothing there and they starve, then they eat garbage. And this is people eating garbage. And since you can't do that for too long, then they just leave. And as I'm going to show you later on, our best estimate is that there are the Venezuelan diaspora is now in excess of 5 million people. That's significantly more than the UN mentions. You know, people talk about 2 point something, but we think it's over 5, and I'll tell you the tools that we have used to try to estimate those numbers. So you might say, okay, you know, there's a crisis, everybody, you know, has seen a crisis. Younger among you will probably remember the 2008-2009 Great Recession, and there are other moments in history of crisis, the Euro crisis. But so if you think of a crisis as a period in which, you know, something, say GDP falls, we can measure at least 3 things. One is, how long does it take for this stuff to come back? What would be sort of like the peak to trough, fall? And you might also want to know, what's this area under the curve? What's the total loss of GDP in that period? So, you know, that's just to get some numbers on the table. So, this is the U.S. Great Recession. It still reverberates. It got Trump elected and so on. GDP fell 3%. It took 3 years to recover the original level, and the total area under the curve was 4%, right? But obviously,
4% of initial GDP?
Of initial GDP. This is Spain and Greece. In Spain, the fall was almost 9% of GDP, and it took 9 years to recover. And the fall in Greece was 27% of GDP. And, you know, I don't know how long it'll take to recover. This is the U.S. Great Depression. GDP fell almost 29%, and it took 8 years to recover. This is the Spanish Civil War. GDP fell 29%, and it took 7 years to recover. So these are sort of major catastrophic events in history. If you go back to just Latin America, this is Chile. So Andres lived through these. The 1973 crisis had a fallen GDP of 16% and lasted 6 years to recover. And then the 1981 crisis, the debt crisis, GDP fell by 15.5% and took 5 years to recover. And the area under the curve is 50% there. And also, these are catastrophic events that you know, have made it into you know, the textbooks of economic history of Latin America, or to big macro textbooks and so on. Argentina, the fantastic crisis of 2002, GDP fell by almost 19%, took 7 years to recover. So all of these are, this is the world records. Okay? So this is Venezuela. GDP has fallen to date by 45%. The IMF came up with the estimate that they expect this year will fall by 18%. So this number should really be more like 50%. It's been 5 years and counting. And if you assume that come January 1st, the economy starts growing at 10% per year forever, the crisis would have lasted 12 years, which is more than any of the other crises I mentioned before. So think of this as twice the Great Depression, twice the Spanish Civil War, three times the largest crisis previously in Latin America. Okay. Now, there are other events sort of like that in history. This is Zimbabwe, where GDP fell by 50%. And there are other crises, but they typically involve either the collapse of the state. These are all former Soviet Union, of which Eric is an expert. Georgia, Tajikistan, Ukraine, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Kyrgyzstan, Russia, Albania, and Turkmenistan. And other countries that had wars, civil wars in Liberia, in Iraq, in Libya, in Rwanda, in Congo, in Iran, in Lebanon. So, you know, if the state collapses and suddenly you create a bunch of borders and you introduce new currencies and you break up commercial relations that were there and so on, you can imagine, you know, a collapse of this nature. If there's a war, you can imagine a collapse of this nature. Well, there hasn't been a state collapse and there hasn't been a war. What the hell could be behind the Venezuelan catastrophe? What the hell could be behind the Venezuelan catastrophe? So that's the question I want to ask myself. Why is such a large collapse if there's been no war and no state failure? So I'm going to tell you first, as they say, you know, first I'm going to tell you what I'm going to tell you, and then I'm going to tell you, and then I'm going to tell you what I told you. Okay? So this is what I'm going to tell you. Okay? But it will become clearer as I show you the evidence. The first thing is that, you know, there's something, I think engineers came up with the term resilience. Yeah, that, you know, you hit something and it tends to, you know, the question is, can it recover, can it go back to its original coherence, right? So the question is, why, you know, if there were any hits to Venezuela, why did it lose its coherence? Why did it implode? Okay, and I think that the secret of resilience is some capacity of complex systems to self-organize. So they self-organize and they auto-regulate, so that if you hit them, they somehow recover, right? And in economies, that system is something that a guy from, I think he was from the British Isles, the northern part, he referred to it as the invisible hand. And the invisible hand is really three interesting mechanisms. One is a price system. You know, things have a price. And secondly, there's a kind of like a profit motive. Firms produce things because they try to make money, but profits depend on price. So a profit motive is like an incentive system to respond to the information that is in prices. And then you have capital markets that try to lend money to those that are expected to be profitable, which are those that are responding to the information that is in prices. So that's sort of like the invisible hand like operating, and there was a massive attack on the invisible hand, a massive attack on economic rights, so you could not fix your own prices, you could not own, things would be expropriated, you could not buy foreign exchange, you didn't have the right to import. So you lost a lot of the mechanisms that would create resilience. Those economic rights were attacked even more when the price of oil went up. After 2004, and especially after 2006, the government accelerated its attack on market mechanisms, private property, and so on. And that attack on economic rights was bad for the economy, but it happened in the middle of an oil boom. And the oil boom allowed you to import. So if domestic production was falling, nobody was crying over anything because you could, if we didn't produce food, we could import food. If we didn't produce steel, we could import steel, and so on. And actually, imports became important not only because the price of oil was high, but also because domestic production was collapsing, and domestic production was collapsing because it was being attacked by this attack on the invisible hand. Not only did the government spend a lot the oil boom, but they borrowed like crazy during the oil boom. So instead of saving for a rainy day, they ended up borrowing in the boom. And that borrowing allowed for an even higher level of imports and capital flight. But this debt actually led to over-indebtedness. And capital markets stopped lending to Venezuela around 2012-2013. At that time, in 2012, Venezuela was spending as if the price was at $200 a barrel when it was only at $100 a barrel. So the first thing that happened was, if you want a sudden stop in capital inflows in 2013 or so, the markets had already stopped lending to Venezuela, but the Chinese were happy to lend. And that started to cause a collapse in imports. That collapse in imports was aggravated when in 2014 the price of oil collapsed. And the collapse in imports led to a collapse in GDP. The collapse in GDP and the fall in oil prices led to a collapse in tax revenues. The collapse in tax revenues led to a big fiscal deficit that was funded by printing money. Printing money led to hyperinflation. Hyperinflation led to the collapse of the financial system, and the collapse of the financial system aggravated the collapse in output. So that's the story I want to say, to tell you. And I'm going to show you these things in numbers. So this is the boom period. So in the boom period, the government spent a hell of a lot more. So if you call 100 what was happening in 1998, they were spending 50% more. Private consumption went up, but GDP didn't respond much. So in the boom, you had a spending boom. It didn't trigger an output boom. And it didn't trigger an output boom because the attack on the invisible hand led, in this period of the boom, to a collapse in manufacturing and a collapse in agriculture during the boom. And a big boom in imports. But imports were not just enough because of high oil prices. In this period of the boom, the economy borrowed like crazy. So the debt was something like $25 billion in 2006. It ended up being above $150 billion. So it increased by a factor of over six, okay, in that period, making Venezuela become, this is the country risk, this is a spread over U.S. treasuries of Venezuelan bonds. This is Latin America, and that's the other EMs. So financial markets decided Venezuela was a very risky place between 2009 and 2013, in which we were borrowing like crazy from China. Okay? And then by 2013, there was these are ridiculous spreads. This is 30 percentage points above U.S. Treasuries. Now it's and this happened while the price of oil was very high. Okay, so, and this makes Venezuela, by far, comfortably, the most over-indebted country in the world. I like to measure the debt as a share of exports, because nobody knows what Venezuelan GDP is. And we will know how to convert it into dollars anyway. So, but in debt to exports, it's say, in at least 5 times exports, 5 years of exports, and the country that comes next is Sudan, so in the world. So it's the most indebted country in the world. And then imports, when the price of oil collapsed, imports had to collapse. And imports collapsed to less than a fifth of what they were in the boom. Okay, so it's this massive contraction in imports to levels that we have never seen. I mean, this goes up to 1983, to levels that we have never seen. And obviously, when the government then couldn't spend anymore, then spending collapsed, but now GDP collapsed. GDP didn't go up during the boom, but GDP collapsed during the bust. And imports that collapsed were across the board. There's a 70% decline in the imports of food. The red line is Venezuela. The other lines are other Latin American countries. You see that it's not a general phenomenon. This is a purely Venezuelan phenomenon that got triggered after 2014. These are some of the items that we stopped importing. I'll let you speed read. This is what happened to while agricultural I showed you agricultural production here during the boom. This is what happened afterwards. So it's not like, okay, Dutch disease during the boom, you import and there's appreciation, but then during the bust you depreciate and you have a boom in tradables. That didn't happen. Importation of medicine also declined by 70%. These are some of the items that they stopped importing. They stopped inoculating children, so now we have diphtheria, we have measles, we're exporting diphtheria and measles to the rest of the region. And these are the largest collapses in medicine imports in the history of mankind since Comtrade put trade data together in 1962. Okay, so you know, you get the war in Cambodia, you have the war in Iraq, you have the war in Liberia, you have the special period in Cuba, the war in Nicaragua, in Sierra Leone, etc. So this is sort of like a catastrophic collapse in imports of medicine, and a catastrophic collapse in oil output. Yesterday, OPEC announced the production of Venezuela. It's now at 1.1 million. So actually this number should be down here. This black number should be down there. And these are levels of oil production and oil production per capita. Oil production that we haven't seen since the 1940s. And oil production per capita that we haven't seen since the 1920s. So this is sort of like you think of Venezuela as an oil exporting country. It's a former oil exporting country. So. And not only did Venezuela see this incredible collapse in GDP, but this incredible collapse in imports. These are the largest collapses in GDP and the largest collapses in imports. The interesting thing is that the countries that are on this list are not on that list, and the countries that are on that list are not on this list. So Venezuela is the only country that makes it to both lists. But if you think the total supply of goods is what you produce plus what you imported. So the total collapse of the availability of goods in Venezuela is in a class of its own. Now, this collapse led to a collapse in tax revenues. This is a 12-month rolling, this blue line is 12-month rolling average or sum of non-oil tax revenues. That went from over $8 billion in 2014, that is the year 2013, to $1 billion. So it's not only that oil collapsed, non-oil revenues declined by a factor of 8. Okay? And it was substituted, was substituted in part by this increase in money printing. Here we're measuring money printing weekly, converted into dollars of that week at the parallel exchange rate. So it went from something like $1 billion to something like $4 billion. So this whole hyperinflation is generating for the government somewhat a little bit less than $4 billion in revenues, all this hyperinflation. So that's the collapse in revenues and That led to this incredible acceleration of inflation. In, according to the latest number, this was for September of last year. Oops. These are the highest hyperinflations in the IMF's monthly data set. The largest is the Congo in the year before September 94. The Latin American record is Bolivia, 23,000. In September, according to the National Assembly, it was 342,000. Its current inflation is much more than, it's much higher than, say, inflation 10 or 12 months ago. So in October, this number is now 800,000. And the IMF expectation is that by December, this number will be 1.8 million. We measure inflation weekly. If we annualize the inflation rate of the last 4 weeks, you get to 44 million percent. Okay. So,
these third countries, these are recent.
Yeah.
Episodes.
So there are only
Weimar
two.
Weimar and all of those are not here.
Weimar in 22. Hungary. And Hungary in 1947 are the only ones that are in our league, but we are not finished. So it's just to say how really unique this situation is. This response with some delay. So come on.
Yes,
so this is the financial system. This is the assets of the financial system measured in U.S. dollars. They were in excess of $70 billion. They are now at $1 billion. So the financial system declined in size by a factor of 70. Okay. So that's the story I just told you. Okay. So how do we get out of this mess? By the way, let me tell you what does this mean from a human point of view, because people say, you know, if I tell you that monthly wages in Venezuela right now are, you know, $12 a month or so, and you tell me, well, but maybe you can buy a lot with $12, etc. So I decided to calculate it in terms of how many hours at the minimum wage do you have to work in order to buy a kilo of chicken or a dozen eggs or a kilo of cheese. And this is the my rendition of a Colombian flag. Okay. So you see that this enormous difference, right? But this was August 2017, because this is now. Okay? So if this is the reality, and by the way, now the public sector wages are capped at 2 minimum wages. This means that the minimum wage went from buying over 70,000 calories a day at the cheapest available calorie to buying way less than 1,000 calories a day.
Can you show the last one again?
Huh?
The previous,
the
cheese.
So Venezuelans, that's the reason why Venezuelans have been losing weight. This is the poverty rate. This is a survey, you know, the government stopped doing household surveys, so the Inter-American Development Bank funded this survey that's done by the three main universities and the three most prestigious universities in the country, and estimated in November of last year a poverty rate of 91% and an extreme poverty rate of 66%. And that was last year, and I showed you the collapse since last year. So So another measure of collapse is maternal mortality rates. It's not infant mortality rates, this is maternal mortality rates.
And these are rates that you see in Africa or don't see in Africa anymore. So this just to say, you know, this is a big phenomenon.
Now, how could we get out of this phenomenon? Well, the first thing, obviously, is you need to restore economic rights. You know, in Venezuela, everybody knows that, you know, one of the most prized items is toilet paper, right? You know, it's made into a news toilet paper and so on. But you say, well, why the hell would toilet paper be a problem, right? Because if people want toilet paper and they're desperate about toilet paper, maybe you and I can get together and let's make some toilet paper, right? Let's buy what is it that we need to buy, maybe some paper, some pulp, some something, and then we start selling toilet paper, and then, you know, soon enough we make a lot of money, we reinvest in more toilet paper, and you know, then nobody talks about toilet paper. And in Venezuela, there is a general, not a military general, you know, in charge of toilet paper. So there's one in charge of shampoo, there's one in charge of rice, there's one in charge. So you militarize, this attack on the invisible hand means that now these things are explicit responsibility of agents of the state. And I challenge you to look around the world, whether you go to North Korea or anywhere you want to go, find the general in charge of toilet paper. But it gives you an idea. So if you restore economic rights, people will start saying, other people's needs is my livelihood. Because, you know, they'll start trying to earn a living by supplying things that people need. But you cannot produce GDP, you cannot produce output without intermediate inputs, raw materials, intermediate inputs, seeds, fertilizers, spare parts for tractors, and so on. And for that, you need to increase imports. But to increase imports, you need somehow to get dollars from somewhere, and they're not going to come from oil because oil is collapsing. So we need to increase imports to increase GDP, and we will need to get international financing to fund this increase in imports. But this international financing will also flow into the government to increase fiscal resources. And that increase in external fiscal resources will allow the government to attend to the humanitarian emergency without printing money. Without printing money. And if you stop monetary printing, then you'll stabilize inflation, you'll recover the financial system, and the country will grow again. So there are two actionable things. You need to restore economic rights, and you need to address the foreign exchange constraint. So to do that, you need to empower society by establishing market mechanisms. You need to lift the external restriction in part by international aid through donations, by international official financing, and by debt restructuring. To make this sustainable over the medium term, we need to recover the oil industry, but we cannot recover the oil industry if we don't have money to invest. But right now, the Venezuelan law says that in order to produce oil, it has to be produced by the national oil company. So we just need to eliminate that restriction and allow other people that have know-how, that have technology, that have money to produce oil in Venezuela and pay royalties, pay corporate income tax, and to resolve, you know, the bankruptcy of PDVSA, because right now, I mean, the oil company is bankrupt and they're not paying their debts, they have no capacity to raise capital. And if we leave things as they are, then we would have to resolve the bankruptcy before we start producing oil. It seems more sensible to let other people produce oil while we resolve that bankruptcy. This is our estimate of Venezuelans abroad. We downloaded from Facebook the number of Venezuelan expats that have Facebook accounts. And there are 3.3 million Venezuelans with Facebook accounts abroad. And then we calculated, we know that there are 12 million Venezuelans in Venezuela with Facebook accounts. So we know the total population of Venezuela. We know that people of different ages have different probabilities of having Facebook accounts. So we could inflate this 3.3 million. I mean, if we had not been so careful, we would have said 3.3 million, that is, there are 12 million Venezuelans in Venezuela with Facebook account. We know that there are 30 million Venezuelans, so that means that there's 2.5 Venezuelans for every Venezuelan with a Facebook account. So you multiply by 2.5. If you multiply 3.3 by 2.5, you get 7 point something million people. But that would be an overestimate because the people who have left are mostly between 25 and 34. They are more likely to have Facebook accounts in Venezuela, so we inflate it differently. So that's where we come with a number of 5.2 million. This week there was a survey done in Venezuela where they asked people, do you have relatives abroad and so on. And through that survey they estimated 5.6 million Venezuelans abroad. This is another trick we use to estimate the Venezuelans abroad. We take everybody who tweeted out of Venezuela in 2017, and we asked, where are they tweeting now? And the total number, that this is by the middle of September, 9.5% of those that only tweeted from Venezuela were abroad. And these are the countries that they seem to be at. So Chile is number three, but getting there. Chile is the number one destination. According to the survey, Chile is the number one destination in terms of desire to go abroad.
Yeah. 500,000 Venezuelans in Chile in the last year.
So, so this, I think, is not in English. you know, as we think of Venezuela, you might think, okay, how can we recover? What can we do to recover? But we also have to ask ourselves the question, what happens if we don't do anything? What happens if the world doesn't do anything? Because right now it's 5 million Venezuelans, but if the oil production keeps on collapsing, output keeps on collapsing, inflation keeps on accelerating, people are leaving in higher numbers than before. So you have to, if you move that picture forward, you have to ask yourself, where is this going? And can the region tolerate it? Can the world tolerate it? Okay. So I think that, this is just to say that I think that the catastrophe in Venezuela is not bad luck. This catastrophe happened at the end of the largest oil boom in history. Andres and I worked on Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan, in many dimensions, is half of Venezuela, except in size. Kazakhstan is the ninth largest country in the world or something. It's bigger than India. So it's a huge place, but they have half the population of Venezuela. They used to have half the oil of Venezuela. During the boom, they accumulated $100 billion between the oil fund and international reserves. So if you multiply that by two, it would be $200 billion. So instead of having $200 billion, we ran out of no reserves, $150 billion in debt, and we made this mess. So this catastrophe is not bad luck. Not bad luck. It's in spite of surprisingly good luck. So I don't think we can get out of it without a drastic change of regime. Right? But that will not be enough. That besides a drastic change of regime, now, as Andres would have said in his famous paper, Growth Diagnostics,
co-author with him.
the binding constraint right now is that there are no raw materials with which to produce. There are no intermediate inputs with which to produce. There are no seeds, no fertilizers, no spare parts, and so on. So you cannot get production up unless you get imports up, and you cannot get imports up unless we have something like a Marshall Plan to help us out. So I think it's imperative. Venezuela will not be able to get out of this either politically or economically without significant international solidarity. Let me leave it at that. Thank you very much.
All right, muy bien. I'm sure there'll be lots of questions, so I'm going to play moderator here. That was a fascinating talk. I've heard Ricardo several times speak about this, and every time I listen to this talk again, I learn something, and I get more depressed, of course, because it is hard to find a story that is more tragic on the one hand and more clearly self-inflicted on the other. All right, I've talked too much, so let me offer that fellow there, and then the gentleman here. Do we have a microphone? Yes, we do. And then the guy in the blue shirt in the back. Why don't we take three questions in sets of three, and in the interest of democracy, so that everybody can speak up, I will ask you to make the questions relatively brief. Ideally with a question mark at the end, not merely declarative.
I wonder if you could advise me what you think is the best way of getting rid of the regime. There seem to be three broad alternatives. One, let it continue to destroy the oil extreme economy and some kind of collapse will occur, but who knows when. Secondly, to cut off all resources as much as possible going into the country, for example, sanction the oil and sanction all other Romanian exports, gold, minerals, and so forth. Because the US basically imports half of the oil anyway that can cut off straight away. And thirdly, to have some kind of military intervention, which probably would be easy enough to do initially, but as we all know, there's a problematic arms race to actually try and run the country.
Thank you. Very good question. Very difficult question. Sir.
Yeah, so I know you have open. Sorry.
Can I borrow a pen?
Does anybody have a pen for Professor Hausmann?
Yes.
Thank you.
So my question is twofold. I know you have openly advocated for intervention, actually, in the past. I would like to know your stance. And as a Venezuelan and as a community, how can we help that to materialize? And the second question, you have also advocated not only for funds and help. IMF, sorry, thank you. Funds to help, but also to open a fund of actual just donations, because there won't be enough. How can some of the funds that have been stolen be actually returned instead of this kind of aid? And are there mechanisms for people helping to do that?
The gentleman in the blue has the last question in this round.
Thank you very much. I have to begin with just thanking you. So just to add up to the first question, how important would you think would be to, for example, a new constitution in Venezuela, taking into account how the social bond has been destroyed during these years. But, so my question, my main question, is about how to finance ourselves after the crisis, and whether, if we should go to the Paris Club, and the IMF, World Bank, kind of go with the West, and if that would imply turning our backs on China and Russia kind of financing, because I am aware that a lot of people in the opposition are reluctant to the idea of going to the Paris Club because of what that would mean. So if you could just elaborate on that, I would really appreciate it.
Excellent. So I must say that I have spent a lot of time thinking about the morning after plan, assuming that other people would take care of the day before. So when I started the project 3 years ago, I didn't plan it as a three-year project. So apparently we haven't taken care of the day before. But at different moments along those 3 years, we thought that the morning after was going to come soon, and to a point that I thought that we were making too little progress on the morning after plan, and relative to what I thought, you know, political change might happen. You know, remember, we won 2/3 of majority in the National Assembly in December 2015, and then we had these massive demonstrations in 2017, and we had referendum organized by civil society in 10 days in which 7.7 million people voted. 3,300 people voted in Copley Square, Boston. So people showed up, amazing. It was 63,000 people voted in the presidential elections of 2013, and 750,000 people voted in that referendum. So in 2017. So we thought that, you know, there was going to be a way out. My dilettante observations, because, you know, I'm a card-carrying economist. Mm-hmm. We have political scientists in the group, mm-hmm. in here, so I'm no political scientist, but you know, the Venezuelan regime is a military regime. So it's not that if there is a military coup, what would happen in a military coup? Look what Pinochet did in Chile, or whatever Pérez Jiménez did in Venezuela. No, a military coup already happened. You know, the Constitution says that the National Assembly has to rule, and the National Assembly has absolutely no power whatsoever. The President is ruling unconstitutionally by decree, and the reason why he's able to do that is because the armed forces have violated their pledge to abide by the Constitution. So Venezuela is a military dictatorship. The regime will end the day that the military decide that they are no longer going to support this regime, and they're no longer going to violate the Constitution. So now the question, what is going to cause the military to abandon their current behavior? And I think, you know, they are into drugs trafficking. I don't know why they're into drug trafficking, because it's so much safer to just traffic gasoline or toilet paper, right? So, but anyway, there seem to be too many military and too little gasoline or something relative to their ambitions. So the point is that I think some pressure has to be exerted on the military to change their ways. So on January 10th is the end of Maduro's presidential period, elected in 2013. He thinks that he got re-elected in May through elections that nobody in the world, except for a couple of countries, recognize, that were called by a constituent assembly that nobody in the world recognizes. So the EU, the US, Canada, the Grupo de Lima have said that they don't recognize the legitimacy of Maduro after January 10th. So, no, it would make sense for after January 10th for the National Assembly to appoint a new president. And that new president should tell the armed forces to obey. Now, what happens if the armed forces don't obey? I think that president should ask for international military assistance to reimpose the Constitution. And I would like to know, in those circumstances, when the cost of disobeying that president are increased by the fact that they are potentially under a military threat, because it's very, you know, it's very, people can be very valiente, very courageous when they are supposed to murder unarmed citizens. But, you know, if it's military to military, they might think twice. So I think that the Venezuelan military should know that the region supports the National Assembly and the president elected by, appointed by the National Assembly, and that should change the calculus of that military. By the way, it's not that the military are all supporting the government. There are over 200 military officers in jail being tortured and so on. The Cuban security police is overworked in Venezuela, and so it's not that it's a unified military behind this president, but I think we need to change. Something has to happen to force them to change their calculus. I said before that Venezuela is a military dictatorship. I think it's really a state that has been taken over by mafias and criminal gangs, some of them dressed as military. I'm going to touch here about the issue of the new constitution before I go to the IMF and financial issues. So I think that Venezuela, I mean, I would ideally want to see a different constitution, but I don't think it's the binding constraint. That I think we have to go back to democracy. I think that will require probably a transition regime that would last, I don't know, a year and a half, 2 years, in which the electoral authorities would be appointed, the electoral rolls would be cleaned up, a Supreme Court would be appointed, and a new Attorney General, a new Controller General. Maybe we might have a regional election before that, and that would allow political parties, first of all, to get out of jail, to be reauthorized, to campaign, to have internal primaries, so we go back and we have a real election, and then after that, it will be politics as normal. So that government should not have the mandate to change more than what is needed to address the emergency, so that strategic decisions afterwards can be taken by a normal democratic society. And I would love to see the debates between different points of view and changes in political parties from left to right and from right to left. And we've all lived through those things and we've survived them. So, and Venezuela had a history of that. Actually, between 1958 and 1998, in those 40 years, you had the three different political organizations shifting powers, I don't know, at least six times or so. So it's not, changes of peaceful changes in power are things we look forward to. But I think maybe that next parliament might think about a constitution, but that will be, 2 years down the road, etc. Before that, we have inflation in the millions and output collapsing and so on. I think we have other priorities. With respect to international finance, first, on the issue of stolen funds, I am all in favor of getting stolen funds back to the country. And I've spoken to two private firms that specialize in that. That's their business model. They try to get those resources and then get them back to a country, and they charge a fee and so on. They take time. So because for good reasons, people protect property rights, and you cannot just find an asset and take it and so on. You have to go to a judge and convince the judge that money was stolen and that it should go back to somebody, and that takes years. So I think that should be done. It must be done for economic reasons, for moral reasons, for political reasons, and I'm all in favor of it. But it's not an alternative to looking for international finance. When you look for international finance, there are many organizations in the world say, why go to the IMF? Why don't you go instead to the IDB or to CAF or to other guys that have sort of like more friendly disposition? But in finance, it's not just the disposition, it's the size of your balance sheet. And the IMF has infinite resources. So the IMF could give us, if they treated us the same way they treated Greece, they gave Greece, among the three programs that they had, 30 times quota. That's a quota is a number that the IMF uses to. They don't use feet or meters; they use quota. and Venezuela's quota is $5.2 billion. Greece got like 30 times quota. 5.2 times 30 is 150 billion. That means infinite from Venezuela's point of view. I've argued that they should give us, they should lend to us 60 billion, something like that, 60, 65 billion, which would be something like 12 times quota, which is something that they've done not only for Greece, but they've done for Morocco, they've done for their, we have a list of all the previous programs where they've given 12 times quota or more. So all of these countries have had crises. Like Greece had a crisis, but it's half the Venezuelan crisis. Okay, so it's not. So. Now they can't give us much more than 60 billion because they need to show that if they give us that money, lend us that money, we will be able to repay it. And there's a limit to, you know, what is our debt carrying capacity. So that's why when we do the numbers, we think that a borrowing is not going to be enough, we will need grants. And we've estimated those grants at something like $20 billion, which is, so we looked at all the big donations in history. And the biggest one was received by the Palestinians between 2009 and 2011. If you convert it in per capita terms at today's dollars, the second biggest was given to Iraq in 2003-2005. And then you have a bunch of them. But in our region, the equivalent in per capita terms, etc., would be $20 billion to Haiti after the earthquake. So when I say $20 billion, people say, oh, but that's, you know, where is that money? That doesn't exist. Well, the world has a history of facing up to these situations. So that's why in our plan we think $60 billion from the IMF, $20 billion in grants, and a very, very deep haircut on the renegotiation of our debt with something like a 70% or so haircut on our existing debt. That's the vision there. China and Russia. Well, China, you know, I, as the director of the Center for International Development, we have programs in many countries. We have programs in Pakistan, we have programs in Sri Lanka, we're developing a program in Ethiopia. I mentioned these three countries because they all have financial crises right now associated with excess Chinese lending. And China was an important player in lending a lot of money during the boom, but lending it in really, maybe I should mince words, in less than stellar way. Okay? they lend in secret terms. Secret. What I mean by secret is that, for example, I know from the Ecuadorian government that the terms of the loan are secret to the cabinet. They sign a non-disclosure agreement where the minister who signs the loan cannot tell the rest of the government about the loan. When they renegotiate in secret terms, and they forbid people from telling what are the terms in which they lend. They lend for projects that don't exist. They lend $65 billion for projects that don't exist. There's nothing to show for the $65 billion that China lend to Venezuela. Not only that, they lend to one entity here and demanded that another entity pay back. So these were collateralized loans. So the guys who received the loans, and something called Fonden, Fondo Chino, etc., they thought that the money, they could piss away the money. They didn't have to pay it back because the oil company was going to pay it back. The oil company realized that they couldn't pay it back because, first of all, they never borrowed the money. They don't have any extra capacity to pay for this new debt. And as a consequence, they went to complain to Chavez, who still was alive. And Chavez said, No problem, Chico, don't worry. The central bank will lend you the money. And that's how the central bank got into the money printing business. So Chinese loans have been catastrophic for Venezuela. I don't think that Venezuela would be where it is today if it wasn't for the irresponsible behavior of China. So I think that China should be part of the solution. China is a millennial place. It's 5,000 years old. It will be 5,000 years from now still there. I hope they start thinking about the future and not so much about the past. We still have a lot of natural resources that they might want to see us develop. But it will be very hard for the other creditors that we will be asking a major haircut. Them knowing that in the period in which Venezuela had defaulted and was not paying them back, the stock of Chinese debt is no longer at 60 billion, it's now at 20 billion. So 40 billion was repaid. When you have a default, sometimes they say, Carlos is going to help me, they're going to say, no, the people who got repaid, they come later. First are the ones who have not been paid, right? So China cannot aspire to be particularly well treated in terms of the old debt unless they participate with a lot of new money. And it will not be able to be in the terms, the collateralized terms of the past, which I think destroyed the budget institutions of Venezuela. Russia is not a player. Russia, there are two sources of Russian debt. One is military stuff like the Sukhoi airplanes and submarines and so on, and the other one is Rosneft. But Rosneft is a listed company. When the stock market found out that Rosneft was financing Venezuela, they took the stock took a hit, and the company had to promise not to lend more to Venezuela, and so I don't think that they are. The Russian mafia might be a major player and a major headache, but they're not part of the solution.
All right. We're going to have three more questions. Professor Berglof here has indicated that I should ask people to introduce themselves. I want to say two things very briefly, given that I have the microphone, right? One is that, I look back to the 18 years, my own country had a dictatorship. And, of course, there were many moments like the moment Venezuela is living through today when it seemed as though it would never end. My father was an opposition leader, and I was a little guy, and I remember meetings in which they said, next March, of course, next March came, and then next March came, and the next March came, and nothing happened. But, as in the old saying about financial crisis goes, change takes a lot longer to come than you expect, and when it comes much more quickly than you expect. And that's precisely why it is so important to be ready for the moment the change comes. The other thing I was going to say, I'm here in my capacity as the dean of LSE, so I have to advertise LSE a little bit. Venezuela is in many dimensions a failed state today. And the LSE just co-chaired with a university called Oxford a commission on failed states with a lovely report, actually a very, very good report, I'm not being facetious here, co-written by our very own Tim Besley. And there's a very politically savvy discussion there of how it is that you get to rebuild the institutions of a state in states that have basically collapsed. I'll give you one headline. You want to do elections, but the elections come last in the sequence. They don't come first in the sequence for very obvious reasons that Besley and company explained very well. All right. The fellow here in the tie has the first word. And then the young lady in the black there, and then the fellow in the sweater there.
Thank you very much. Diego Moyo Campos, principal analyst of IHS Market, formerly known as James. Okay. My question goes, obviously, Venezuela's main source of revenue is the oil sector. How much more should oil production decline to get towards the point where the government is no longer able to pay the security forces, the military, to contain protests, civil unrest, or to guarantee the loyalty? And linked to that question, even if it reaches such level of decline of oil production, would it be the case, as we are all aware, that the Venezuelan military is highly engaged in drug trafficking, fuel smuggling, and illegal mining? Shouldn't they still be capable of generating revenues enough to keep the security apparatus containing civil unrest and also guaranteeing the loyalty of police and military forces?
Hello, my name is
Marie
from Venezuela. And I want to address an issue that I believe that is in Venezuela. I want to address an issue that I believe is not well documented when we are talking about the Venezuelan crisis, and that is the role of criminal institutions or organizations such as those drug cartels in the Venezuelan struggle for power. So, in your opinion, what is the role or how effectively are these organizations, criminal organizations, helping the Venezuelan government to stay in power, and how can we measure its impact? I know that it's difficult, but do you have any data about that? And lastly, how can we put this policy actor, these criminal organizations, in your chart of the solution of Venezuela? Because I believe that they are a very important policy actor that we should negotiate with them when we are going to restore democracy.
So,
thank you.
The gentleman in the gray sweater there in the front.
Thank you very much. My name is Salvador Ortega. I'm from Guatemala. So my first question is a rather boring one. It's about data. Usually when you deal with closed regimes, I work with Nicaragua, data is very hard to get because it's not in the government's interest for that data to be public. So, for example, tax revenue, I'm curious on how are you getting your data, firstly. And secondly, on the political reconstruction, I want to pick up on your comment about party elections being the last stage. The transition, then, what kind of political transition are you envisioning or do you have in mind? And what kind of process do you have in mind for the political reconstruction of parties, of institutions, and whatnot?
Todo tuyo. Vamos a ver.
Good. Okay, so, you know, Diego's question is about how much more do revenues have to fall?
You can tell the guy he's becoming a politician when he writes down the names of people. Diego's question. Welcome transition, Professor Hausmann.
The idea is, you know, if revenues fall, the regime collapses. There have been many political transitions in Latin America. There has never been a recession of this magnitude. So by the standard of previous transitions or bad economic performance leading to regime change, it should have happened in Venezuela long ago. So I'm no longer willing to believe that there is this sort of like connection between how bad the economy does and so on and the survival of the state. My reformed model, if you want, is that if the economy does poorly, it weakens the government, but it also weakens society. And the question is, what happens to the relative power of the government over society? And our intuition is if you just think about how it weakens the government, you forget about its weakening society too. So for example, right now, if you want to eat in Venezuela, you have to behave. Because the government has substituted the distribution of food by some boxes, and if I give you the boxes if I want, and I'll give it to you conditional on your behavior. So actually, hunger has been a form of social control. You know, if they don't have money to pay for the army, they will allow the army to steal. And so, which is what's happening, right? So there are, you know, George Orwell was, you know, emphasized, you know, the role of doublespeak. So there's something cruel. Something in Venezuela which are called zonas de paz, which are peace areas, which are really war zones, but they're called zonas de paz, peace areas, and there are areas in which the government doesn't get in. They allow the criminal groups to run them, right? And so that way they save themselves the trouble. They don't have to pay the wages, etc. They let people pay themselves with loot. Okay, so we now have because now there's this collapsing state. There are people with comparative advantage in force, and for example, with years of experience and training, which are called the ELN, the Colombian ELN, and the dissident part of FARC. So now they control ample parts of the Venezuelan territory. So this idea that you know, if the situation continues to weaken, the government somehow will be toppled, I'm not sure that that's... They need to create alternative ways for these guys to sustain themselves. There is they've been exporting gold to Turkey, and now the Americans have tried to cut down the gold exports to Turkey. We don't know where this gold is coming from. We don't know who got the money. Definitely didn't go to the government. So it is really becoming a true criminal organization, which is a little bit the question that Cristina was posing. So it's ironic that in a military regime, the Venezuelan armed forces have lost the monopoly of power, and now they share power, and the geography has been now distributed to mafia groups called Pranes in Venezuela, and the ELN, and etc., and the mining area, El Arco Minero. So I still think that the baseline case is that, you know, I don't know that how much you cannot negotiate. Who was it? Teddy Roosevelt, who said, "Speak softly but carry a big stick." So I don't think that you negotiate with a small stick, right? So we need to think about what's going to generate the stake that will be able to reimpose the monopoly of power in the country itself. If we negotiate now, they'll be pointing a gun at you, and you'll be sort of like scolding them. Alfredo asks the question of data. First, data. Well, we've invested a ton of effort in finding ways of collecting data. And that's why, you know, Facebook, Twitter, you know, the minimum wage is easy to know because it's published. But then we measure weekly inflation, and so it's a big thing. But there are these bureaucracies that still have some attempts at prestige. So the central bank has stopped publishing GDP numbers, but they publish financial numbers. And the tax authority is very proud of their taxing thing, so they publish their monthly tax revenues and so on. So we exploit data where it is to try to generate a picture of things. The world reports exports, so we can report what the world says they export into Venezuela. So that's how we get the numbers for medicine and so on. So it's a big archaeological effort, but it can be done. On political transition, I think that's a very, you know, there are many ways in which this can go. It can be just a plain collapse. We should not discount the fact that this may end in a very messy, confused situation of civil wars between those gangs that are now empowered. So we should, I think the international community wants an orderly transition, and I think that an orderly transition will require, you know, some threat to misbehavior, because the thing can become very dangerous. And I think I'm done.
We're going to do two more sets of questions. I want to say, as I listened to Ricardo describe what they're doing in Cambridge with a bunch of Venezuelans, I'm tempted to say, you know, in my country, the generation that got to study overseas and acquired human capital, you know, we used to say that we got the Pinochet scholarship. You know, I think that the Maduro scholarship and the Chavez scholarship are going to be much bigger and much more efficient because a very talented generation of Venezuelans has been trained overseas. The young woman with the blue and the black in the back, and then over here. Okay?
Thank you. Hi, Ricardo. My name is Valerie. I'm from Venezuela, consultant and coordinator of Venezuelan Globales, which is a network that supports female Venezuelan immigrants in London. So, my question is about an official problem, which is the opposition, or sort of a fake opposition. And we need a group in Venezuela that will help us with the transition. And right now, I feel that we don't have that. Is there someone in Venezuela that you think could lead this transition? Because I'm pretty sure that any foreign government would need some sort of guarantee that in case of an intervention, someone will take the lead and create a new government. And if you have someone in mind, who that person is there a way that we can help and support the person? And also in terms of the fake opposition, do you have any thoughts on that? Is there a way that we can expose this fake opposition internationally? Because so far, every time the European Union or other groups keep talking about sanctions and everything, we see this fake opposition opposing to that. So instead of helping Venezuela, they are like creating more damage.
Right behind you. Can you get up so that other people can see you and hear you?
So recently, the chairperson of IMF, so Christine Lagarde, asked for the World Central Bank to create their own crypto coin. So if we look at the morning after situation in Venezuela, I'm curious as to what your opinion is on this and if you think it could help solve some of the hyperinflation issues.
Crypto.
Daniela Guerra, I'm also Venezuelan and director of
Daniela.
And director of a human rights NGO that is based in Venezuela.
Called Codex.
Mm-hmm. I have two questions. Exactly one linked to the human rights situation basically. When you talk about probably military intervention, isolation of regional forces probably where would you think that decision would come from? From the American system or the UN system or just something that states would argue by themselves because there's not much precedence of this kind of situation? And also, how would you evaluate the international community measures so far? For instance, the individual sanctions and how effective do you consider those have been?
And in making the military change its mind, can one touch their pocket? Ex ante and not exposed? Mm-hmm. As a follow up to your question.
Okay, so Valerie, I had the privilege of organizing a meeting at the end of September at Harvard. That was attended by a significant number of the political parties and Frente Amplio, Fe Cámaras, Comindustria, Fede Agro, the Church, etc. And I think that there's a lot of talent in the room. I think that we have very, very talented politicians that in a democracy, they would rock. But Venezuela is not a democracy. And political action, political parties were not created to fight dictatorships. They were created to run elections. They were created to have guys and girls who can, you know, articulate people's frustrations and aspirations, sell them on a vision and a plan, kiss babies, run elections, win, etc. Right? So that's what a political party is. It's not an organization that can deal with oppression very well. So I think the Venezuelan opposition is composed of three groups: those that are in jail, those that are in exile, and those that are free. And that's not a random set. It's not, oh, you're, what's your number? Oh, you go on exile. You, oh, what's your number? Oh, you don't go. It's conditional on behavior. So the ones that are free are conditionally free. And I've noticed a very strong difference between those that are in exile and those that are free at home, because those that are free at home say, for example, there was a meeting at Harvard. Fernando Albán did not come to the meeting at Harvard. He went back to Venezuela after the UN meeting. He arrived in the airport. He was tortured to death and thrown from a 10th floor and murdered. He was a council member. Okay, the other ones that were in the room at Harvard and had to go back after they murdered Fernando Albán, what do you think? Well, I want to do opposition. I want to remain free and alive. How do I behave, right? So it's, I want us to, when we see their behavior, let's consider that. Having said that, I think that Zapatero has been a disaster for Venezuelan democracy. Those that have peddled Zapatero have done real harm to Venezuelan democracy. If there's anybody that's going to mediate that negotiation, it's somebody can give real guarantees. So, for example, if you leave the government, I'll guarantee you that you'll be able to leave. As President Santos even suggested that they should leave with some money so that we can promise them to. They call this, in the U.S., they call these off-ramps. So, it's, you know, if you're going to get off the highway, you have to sort of like, there has to be a path for them to leave power. So all of these things. But I think that he has been an agent of the government, and his behavior is really unacceptable. But I do think that I would love to see a free competition between Leopoldo, Enrique, Maria Corina, etc. I would like to see a debate between them. I would like to see not only sort of like, you know, in the morning after this nightmare is sort of like over and reconstruction starts, I want them to compete on their vision of how they are going to reconstruct the country and so on. But I have the highest regard for many political leaders in Venezuela, and I think we should understand, you know, the degree of sacrifice and effort that they have put in. I have preferences. But I would like Venezuelans to have the opportunity to express those preferences, and I can live with some of them. I'll vote, but Cristina, I don't think cryptocurrencies can help or are important. The government created this Petro. I think it's a sham. It's a joke. I don't think that it goes through. FinTech is not a solution to the kind of problems we have. Daniela, I'm very concerned about the human rights situation in the country. It's amazing how many, 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 many people have been put in jail, tortured in jail, my own family, you know, my brother-in-law is still under house arrest. He spent 8 months in solitary confinement, lost 20 kilos, and this is just one more of hundreds and hundreds of. So the human rights situation in Venezuela is really catastrophic. I think the question of who commands military action, it becomes legally very much simpler if it's coordinated by a president legally appointed by the National Assembly. The political transition in Venezuela, I think, should be led by the National Assembly. That everybody in the world recognizes the legitimacy of the National Assembly. Now we can discuss how, you know, their behavior in the past and so on, but we elected them. They haven't been able to act, not because they decided not to act, but because their powers were taken away. But I think that they are in power until January 2021. And I think that if we're going to remove Maduro, we should preserve as much as possible of a constitutional order. And I think they should have a say in the recreation of that government, and it will make the international community have much fewer qualms if this is a president that was appointed by the National Assembly, that everybody recognizes their legitimacy. You have to go to UN Security Council when one state decides to invade another state. But to ask for help is, you don't have to go to UN to ask for help. I mean, you're free to ask for help. And people, you know, are free to decide to give you help. So I think that from a legal point of view, the president would be empowered to ask for military assistance, and any country should be legally empowered by international law to provide that assistance. So I think that element is new, at least in this scenario. Okay. So that's why I think that having the National Assembly play a key role in this. In this process facilitates many things, including that one. And your question about the military sanctions, well, many of the military are sanctioned already. But, you know, the loot is very large. So, you know, the vice president, he's known, what is he now? Tarek El Aissami. Mm-hmm. What position does he have now? He was vice president.
Right.
He was sanctioned, and you know, in the U.S., they froze $900 million in assets. I presume that he didn't have all his assets in the U.S. Mm-hmm. No, but I don't know. I'm guessing. So $900 million, the vice president of Venezuela is frozen in the U.S. So it gives you a sense of the magnitude of the loot. So. He has been hurt. Many of the military are also on the sanctions list, but up to now, we haven't seen a change in behavior.
All right, one last round. I know Ricardo has to be out of here in the next 10 minutes or so. There's a hand back there. Yes, there we go. Professor Berglof here, he wants to speak up, and the gentleman in the sweater there.
Hello, my name is
Soria.
I'm from Venezuela, so. My question is, if the political parties are not meant to fight against the president, which one do you think is the role of the political parties at the moment in the region?
Eric.
Eric Bergel. The deeper the crisis gets, the more people suffer, of course, the more the demand for revenge will be there. And of course, knowing about the possibility of revenge, assume would entrench itself even deeper. So how do you view this notion of what kind of justice can you imagine, you know, after the regime has fallen?
Very good question. And there we go.
Thank you. My name is Jacob. I'm from Venezuela as well. My question was about when you mentioned Marshall Plan, the first thing that popped into my head was Plan Colombia, and how that helped Colombia in the resolution or somewhat resolution of their conflict. I just wanted to know whether it's helpful to draw parallels in things that the Colombian government has done to deal with all of the criminal organizations in the country, and whether that kind of aid you think is necessary to move the country as kind of like a state building towards transitioning to democracy again. Thank you.
There was one more question here, and I think you had the last, was the last hand up, so why repress? We had too much repression, let's have a little liberation here. So you've got the last question.
Thank you very much. Gabriel Ponte, also from Venezuela. You laid out a plan for, you know, how do we get out of a crisis called the morning after. Do you have a view of what would be the year after? So how do we avoid, you know, getting back into this mess? In Venezuela's economy wasn't necessarily stellar before Chavez, and there's a reason what we got Chavez. Do you have a view of what economic policy or what things to let you do if you want to, you know, become competitive again?
I can recommend to you an editorial I'm putting together precisely on that point. You can download it now for no charge. Professor Hausmann, the word, the floor is yours.
Well, first of all, the first question, I didn't get your name.
Maria.
Maria, the role of political parties. You know, one thing is the normative question, what should be the role of the political parties in a dictatorship? The fact is that it's hard to, I mean, political parties as an organization were normally designed in a democracy to play a certain role. And Venezuela had a history of democracy, and so the political organization of the organization of these parties is what it is, right? If you are fighting a dictatorship, maybe you're a clandestine organization. Maybe, right, it's a different thing. So that's what I'm saying, that you know, we saw what was the name of these? La Resistencia, and other forms of protest. By the way, the April 11th and 12th, 2002, was led by Fede Cámaras and CTV and so on. So it was not. It was Frente Amplio has a lot of other social organizations. There's a resurgence of protest in Venezuela as we speak. But they're not organized by political parties. So I'm just saying, people have put a lot of effort and energy in organizing, but we're not playing solitaire, right? There's a government on the other side putting people in jail, killing, threatening. You know, what they did in 2017 is that you would go and protest, and you would go back home, and when you were at home, they would attack and destroy your building. They were not sort of like disrupting a protest in the street. They would go into buildings, they would actually destroy doors, elevators, and smash things and so on, so as to sort of like pay back revenge and so on. You know, think of a party like Voluntad Popular. They have their central committee or whatever
It's not called Central Committee.
Equipo
but,
Nacional.
Yeah? Equipo Nacional. There are like 12 people, of which like two or three. So, you know, thank God for Skype and WhatsApp and this, that, and the other, but that's how we operate. So it's tough. Eric asks for, you know, the issue of demand for revenge and entrenchment and so on. There are groups, one of the members of my team is Jose Ignacio Hernandez, who's a really, really brilliant Venezuelan lawyer, and he writes all the draft laws for all the things for the morning after and so on, but with Carlos Bellorin on the oil side. But so I know they're working on a transitional justice law, and obviously, you know, it's a complicated issue. You'll want to say you'll be okay if you were not too senior, but it will always be controversial. Mm-hmm. So these guys who were violating the law and violating human rights, now they're going to get special treatment under the new regime, while the other ones don't get the special treatment because they're no criminals. So it's always controversial and complicated, but people are working on it. Jacobo asks for, you know, Plan Colombia. Plan Colombia cost the U.S. $10 billion. So just to put some numbers on the table. It did change. Initially, it was not anti-FARC and so on. It was just narco trafficking restrictions and so on. And it then became something that eventually strengthened the government vis-a-vis the paramilitary groups and some people would say facilitated the final resolution of the conflict. I don't know that it's final or that it's resolution, but
it is a conflict.
No, it is a Nobel Prize in any case. So, so I think that everybody has that example in mind. That Venezuela is much more a failed state now than Colombia ever was. So when people hear me talk, the typical question they ask me is, what about security? How are you going to assure security? And I think it's not my area of expertise, but it's something that needs a lot of thought, because recreating the monopoly of power is central. As this guy from the northern part of this island said, mm-hmm. Peace, easy taxes, and a tolerable administration of justice. No? But we start with peace. So I think it's an important element. And Gabriel asked the question of, so we change, we fix some of the macro things. What will actually change the way Venezuelans behave, their expectations, and so on? I honestly hope that in the end, this whole catastrophe will translate into something like a teaching moment. That, you know, there are some things that we did, there were sort of like conventional wisdom. It ended up so badly that, you know, people are going to say, never again shall we do X, Y, or Z. In the 1980s in Peru provided that. And by the way, now that I look at the number of the 1980s in Peru with Alan Garcia Uno, it's a cakewalk compared to the Venezuelan catastrophe. But it led to a country that has essentially no political parties. Every election is won by a candidate of a different political party, even if he's the same president as before. he changes political parties as you change, I don't know, underwear. But there is a social acceptance that we cannot go back to hyperinflation. There are some things that are not done, etc., that are sort of like part of the national ethos, which is said about Germany and their hyperinflation experiences and so on. So I would like to make a list of the things that we'll say never again, right? And it's interesting to ask, you know, what would that list include? But, there's inflation, so, you know, Maduro announces 35,000 new price cuts, right? There is the idea that that controls, that expropriation, that threats on the private sector and so on are a way forward. And maybe those things, people say, that sounds like what got us in trouble in the first place. I've always wondered how come we cannot transform the term rojo rojito in sort of like an insult or a bad thing. That es una suena rojo rojito, right? So end of story, so checkmate, right? So I had a meeting with a group of Venezuelans and I asked them to say what it means to be Venezuelan in one word. And to there's this thing called polev, you know? Polev, yeah, you should use it. It's a way of doing surveys in class, but the people vote with their cell phones. And then you show the results on the screen. And so I asked them, and then one of the ways you can show the results is by a word cloud. And so I say, okay, so now everybody say one word what it means to be Venezuelan. And the most frequent word was huge on the screen, was resilient. So this crisis, in some sense, has transformed the identity. That we're resilient. If you hear Chileans or Argentinians speak of Venezuela, I saw a tweet the other day. Says, my beautiful city of Buenos Aires is always better, and now it's better than ever, because besides all the things that we always had, now we have Venezuelans, and Venezuelans have taught us to smile, to be kind, to be always optimistic, and so on. So suddenly, you know, it was Julio Cortázar who said, aprendí a ser argentino en París. So I learned to be Argentinian in Paris. So now we go to the rest of the world and they say, oh, these guys work. The self-image of Venezuelans have been transformed by this exodus and this diaspora and so on. So I think that we need to reinvent what really makes us us. Obviously, the fact that you guys are all here, the Venezuelans among you, is that you care, you are concerned. And that, in some sense, expresses the fact that you feel deeply about it and you want to feel good and proud of it, and we have to articulate what that means and how could we use those values and those feelings to construct a better country.